Who is that knocking at my door? On the laptop.
Hi.
Now you can't even tell which laugh is which.
After this point, we're only going to be communicating through sound.
Yeah. Just saves you a lot of time.
We actually had a project where we were supposed to create something ephemeral, and we were just going to create a soundboard of all the answers.
It's kind of genius.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to Halloween Hour with Jen and Kai.
Hello.
Make sure you get a little closer. You can hear what it's like really like in your head.
Good luck trick or treating, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have fun out there.
Yeah. I was debating whether or not to come in costume.
Nobody came in costume.
I mean, my costume's outside in the car.
Is it? Now. So you could like show back up in costume.
Yeah.
All right. So for anybody that is just now discovering you guys, I'll probably slaughter what it is you guys actually do. But in my mind, you're industrial designers and sculptors and artists, basically. And I'll let you guys kind of go more into that in a minute. But I think we heard about the work you did basically just through a series of kind of furniture pieces you guys made and light pieces you guys make and fun little weird little like coasters and like rugs and stuff. Is that how you classify yourself as industrial designers?
I mean, that's primary, like that's the title we kind of think of as just industrial designers because it is already so broad, right? It covers so much. In our minds, we think of ourselves as industrial designers, yeah.
And so you're based in Sunset Park?
Yeah. Cool. We've been down there for about five years now. Yeah.
Okay. And how long have you guys been Chen and Kai?
I mean, our whole lives, jeez. 7 years now?
Eight now. We started, I think, like March 2011.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's been a minute. Yeah.
Wow. And then, I'd like to basically just work backwards from what you were doing today and, like, sort of generally today back to even before you guys started and stuff. Yeah. So what did you do today?
So right now we're getting ready for to show some new pieces in Design Miami in first week of December. So that means everything needs to be in a crate, you know, in 2 weeks. So we're really basically putting the finishing touches on things so that they can be photographed next week. And then
can you say what these pieces are?
It's like a variety of things, but mostly it's it's more like we're really material based. Okay. So like everything's made with these split stones, and then some of them are these surfaces that are held together with this complex steel armature, and then some of them where the stones are UV bonded onto a piece of glass. So you know, in one case there's like a lot of like you could see like how much structure there is just to support this surface, and on the other hand it's these pieces where like the stone is supposed to, it's like magically floating in space, right? So it's like this kind of, even though it's the same idea, it's like that shown in kind of a two different ways.
So like this morning I dropped all of the metal, our metal work off to this, to the powder coater to get painted. And while we've spent maybe more time on doing the metal work than anything else, it's going to try to be as invisible as possible. It just needed to be like this, all these custom armatures to hold up some 35 individual stones.
So they're about the size of, let's say, like a bread roll.
Is it similar to the table that's in Lauren's Primary Essential store here?
That was like the first time we kind of explored that idea of like kind of making these stones float on a surface. But then as we started making other pieces, it's really so we're kind of constrained by the biggest size of the stone with the saw that we have to cut it. And so when you have these similar in size units to compose something with, it can kind of look when you do large surfaces look like a surface treatment, you know, and it does something like it looks somehow like industrially made, and it loses some kind of character to it. So as like an exercise in like kind of like figuring out how to like recapture that feeling, we started making pieces without the glass. So it's just individual stones.
Oh, I've seen photos of those ones.
Yeah. Sure. So like those kind of like helped us work through the idea, and now we're reapplying it to these like glass pieces.
So like from, was Lawrence Table one of the first ones you guys started playing with this cut stones a little bit?
Basically, yeah, basically.
So like with this specific lineage of work from the, keep calling it Lawrence Table, to now the Design Miami pieces you're putting out, is it common that you stick in a sort of material theme for one, just study like cut stones in this case? You're like, we're going to look at cut stones for the next whatever period of time and just and like run with it?
Yeah, I mean, this has been going for maybe like a little over a year.
Okay.
But I still think that's like a relatively short period of time to investigate like a totally new way of making something, you know? So yeah, at the same time, like as we are like, I guess, experts in doing this, you know, more than a year ago, it still seems like very, like, you know, we're very early on in kind of figuring things out still.
I mean, we're dabbling in a lot of different things, you know, so it's we're in, you know, this, the table is both, like, in this UV gluing field, in like, traditional countertop stone sanding and polishing, in this sort of lapidary world for small gem cutters. We're buying weird rocks on eBay, amongst other places, to like from people that would that are like other people that are bidding on it are doing jewelry stuff to sort of these like I mean we're gonna be going to Tucson to the gem show in February
with this sort of lineage of products in mind.
Yeah. So it's like we're always like I mean everything that we're dabbling in is it has like a really big world attached to it, but we're like kind of, you know, at the corner of all these Venn diagrams, right? And like kind of like taking a little bit of here, a little bit of there. And that's why it's like, I mean, often we'll try to be, you know we have this problem where like we come upon this new process and then we end up buying all this equipment to, you know, make these things ourselves. And we're constantly like, no, find somebody else to do it, find somebody else to do this. And the thing is, you can't if you want to do things that involve multiple things combined.
Right.
You know, nobody wants to deal with you. So we kind of have always ended painting ourselves into these corners where we have to kind of do like figure these things out ourselves. Just like little things like, you know, when you UV bond a stone to a...
Can you explain what UV bonding means?
It's basically how they fix cracks in windshields. So like that's probably the most often... you know, way that people would encounter it. But it's also like, you know, those like cheap TV consoles that were like really popular, maybe more in like the 90s, early 2000s, where it's just like these steel rods that glued to a piece of glass, right? There's no, it's not like mechanically connected, it's glued. So it's like really structurally strong, right?
It's a very strong, very clear glue that cures.
So it is an adhesive, like it is a material.
Yeah, it's basically an epoxy that is, when you shine a UV light on it, cures in about 10 seconds.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, so it's you can glue things really quickly, and it's perfectly...
And like really precisely,
clear,
I guess.
And optically clear.
That's amazing.
There's also this whole other section of it, which is you can buy these glues that are for your surfboard, for patching your surfboard on the go in the sun, so the sun will cure the glue there.
That one I know. That one I'm like really... There's another one I just came across that a friend showed me that's like, it comes in a tube, and you pinch it, and you mix the compound.
Yeah.
And that's actually been, in terms of, like, for the instant crack fixing a surfboard, has been the most magical one I've ever found. Because then it's, like, super sandable.
Yeah.
But it takes maybe 10 minutes to cure.
That's,
And it's not, you don't have to mix kind of liquids or anything. It's just a totally dry putty.
McMaster Car sells this stuff, which is fiberglass patch kits. So it's, like, it's just the two parts of epoxy that already a piece of fiberglass cloth that are in, it's, like, in this pouch. So you, like... break the seal, squeeze it back and forth a couple times, and then you can patch.
Like, as is, like the whole patch is just ready to go.
It's ready to go. It's incredibly strong. So it's sort of like very clean. We actually made a thing which.
Yeah, I don't.
We gave it to Printed Matter, and I'm sure it's like slowly leaking fluids in there.
We took like a fucky fucking fuck t-shirt uh-huh. and we cut out the graphic. And so it's like a thing for, you know, to vandalize something. You know, it's like it's the shirt is already like impregnated with part A of the epoxy. And then you just unclip it and mix part B in. And you just tear it out and you could slap it on something. And it's just permanently there.
This is like 6 years ago. And I'm sure if they haven't used it, then it's bad. Or yeah.
So that, I mean, the reason I was curious about the Rocks one is, and one of the reasons I think your work stood out when I first saw it was it's always really materially rich, like more than any other, again, industrial design that I can think of. Like the it's always so uniquely you guys, and even that when I was trying to think, are you industrial design? It was a hard of a weird thing to say because it almost felt like you were. It was more in the art practices that had a certain function behind them, because they always. And I was curious, one of the questions was like, how much of the work you do is commissioned versus you just inventing it and running with it and making something maybe to sell later on?
I think, like, you know, also when we first started, there was, the distribution channels weren't so developed in New York. Hmm. So it was more like you just kind of had to make it first and then figure it, like, people would then contact you afterwards. Hmm. So, like, it's, you know, we often get asked, like, how do you get your things manufactured? Like, well, we started self-manufacturing before we had access to manufacturers, right? And then a lot of the products end up being like things that we already did a run of, and then somebody else will come along and then we'll, like, you know, rework it a little bit for their production.
Got it.
And then, you know, it's like it's way easier to sell an idea to somebody if it physically is already a product, you know? And so, yeah.
We don't have, like, a signature. I mean, maybe there's, like, a general style that we have, but there's no signature sort of thing that we do. So, like, we're now finally being approached by people to, like, blind make things. But even then, it's, like, it's sort of a hard sell.
Meaning
to, like,
they just trust whatever you guys output.
Yeah, it's just, like, yeah. And, like, they kind of, at this point, when we work with manufacturers, they kind of understand that our process is not this. It's a bit backwards, actually. Mm. You know, like, we actually have to see what your production facility looks like in a way so that we can design something that makes sense, you know? And it's, we've always, and part of it has always been because, like, for us, because we, when we go to find a factory ourselves to make something, we're doing such small runs that we can't really make a big ask, you know? So in a way, we have to, like, make our design work around what they already do.
Interesting. Okay.
Right. So, and in a way, it's like, it's,
can you give a, like, a specific example of
practically, like, Chen, we've been using a couple of these places, which are machinists. So it's, that would seem very simple to, it's a tried and true practice. You draw something technical and they will make it.
It's very precise thing.
And that should that should just be like a cut and dry method of production. But Chen recently went to go to the factories, and so he actually saw what machines they had and what they were doing, and sort of these, it just really changed our mind. So, like, one of the factories really specializes in tiny, tiny shit. So it's like, it's tiny, like, custom screws. Mm. And we were trying to do something larger with them, and that's, you know, it just wasn't the
meaning best way you want to do something larger with them before you saw the factory.
Yes. I mean, and we're not talking about that big. We're talking about, like, you know, the size of a golf ball versus the size of, like,
sort of like order of magnitude of what they do, I guess.
Exactly.
It's a different
thing. And it's like really, like, actually understanding specifically what each factory you're working with does at, you know, what is the best that they do. Like, we made this desk pen that's going to market now, where it's like the base of the pen is made in one factory, and the pen is made at another factory across town, because we realized that those are, you know, it's like the same metal, same, could be done on the same machines, but we just knew that they could do it. They specialized differently.
So,
and it was just easier for everybody if we didn't, you know.
I mean, it's always mind opening when you go to a factory. Like, several years ago, we went to AreaWare's casting factory. So they cast plastics and cement there. And we met with the owner, and we realized that the whole place looked exactly like our studio. It was like our studio with twice as many people on it. but you just realized, like, how, and I mean, you somehow, I just, before you went there, I imagined that there would be this large sort of industrial facility, but it's just like, it's just a couple just of guys.
People making stuff.
Yeah. Making stuff. Huh. And
it's like, you know, there's like a big whole handmade thing. It's like everything that has like made in China sticker, it's handmade too, you know? And it's like, it's incredible how much hand labor goes into everything.
So like imagine, so they have these contracts with like Hallmark, maybe it's Disney.
I don't
even know who they have contracts with. They don't exist anymore anyway. Yeah. But you go into see what's going on, and it's like these things you see in stores, and it's somebody actually hand painting the polka dot pattern. Right. On
Always picture it's just like a perfectly clean assembly line of robotic arms.
Yeah.
Pumping out stuff.
Yeah. I mean, what's really incredible is often they don't know why they're making things. Like, so they were making baseball bobbleheads, and when they make, like, you know, it was like right before Avengers 2 came out, so they knew that they were making like the Thor bobblehead. They didn't know who Thor was, right? But then they were like, "But who is this guy?" And I was like, "And why do I only get one gigantic order and then never again?" And I had to explain to them like how they give away bobbleheads at the game.
And it was like one player, a specific player.
Yeah. And they had that day where they give away, right? And it's like that's why you never get that order again.
We also like they're clearly making some kind of sex toy part, and like I mean,
do they know that when they're doing it?
They probably knew that, but we were just trying to get them to admit that they were doing that. And they were just like, "Oh, I don't know what this must be a flan, like something to seal it."
What city was this in?
It's in Dongguan. So in the south, you know, near Guangzhou, there's like four like kind of adjoining gigantic mega cities that basically where everything is made. Mm. Shenzhen more for electronics, but like pretty much everything is made in Dongguan, which is a little bit north. Guangzhou is where like the convention center is. We went to this convention where it's called Canton Fair, and it's like it's like six Javits centers put together, and you can go source a toilet paper manufacturer. Huh. Or the year we went, it was right before hoverboards where it got really big. You know, and it's actually, you can kind of see what's going to come up off, you know?
That's so nuts. Yeah. So is your process basically, is your work always start in your studio, or does it start first with visiting manufacturers, figuring out some sort of context or like collaborator you have to work with?
I think everything kind of bleeds into each other.
I mean, we'll usually try to make a prototype with whatever tools we have in the studio just to get the thing in our hand and to see what that feels like. I mean, even if the process would be like a casting thing, which, you know, we're casting thousands of these parts, and we can't do that in our studio, but we can make something in metal that kind of looks the same, which you can kind of use, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, like what you were saying, like how, like, we don't, most designers start from a sketch and then move to, like, a rough model and then to, you know, like a working prototype, that kind of thing, and then, you know, appearance model, stuff like that. And for us, it's, I don't know if I could actually design something straight out of my head. Like, I can't, like, conceive of it that well. Like, it's, you know so much more if you just sketch it out in the act. I mean, this is a really luxurious way of working, but, like, to actually, if you're going to design a metal part, like, just make something roughly out of metal. Mm-hmm. Of that size, you get the feeling for the weight. You get
like roll it around.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, it answers so many questions that you didn't need to ponder. You know,
well, it's like when you're designing on the computer, it ends up being like, oh, it's like based off this simple geometric solid because that's the first thing that I drew, and then it went from there. So then, but if you're actually making the thing, it, you know, you can start off at any point, and then
in terms of like a starting point, let's say we're talking about the pieces you're installing in Miami. What do you do after that? Like, how do you decide what the next project is or next step is? Do you have a lineup of things you want to explore? Are there commissioned pieces that you're waiting to do?
There's like a couple of different things. Like, we have what we work with our gallery to produce like these like things in our studio that are, you know, one-off or limited edition pieces. Right, like the stone stuff. Mm-hmm. But then we also design like small, like specialty goods that kind of, you know, we sell wholesale to boutiques.
Mm-hmm. They don't have like a limit.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, in most cases, we produce like you know, like 600 to 1,000 sure. pieces. And they're technically unlimited, but it's like right. we're not making more than 1,000 pieces. But yeah, so there's like these two sides of the business.
Okay.
But with the kind of wholesale products, you're like on a wholesale like buying cycle for the stores, right? So stores buy in February and then they buy again in August, you know? So like your product development cycle is based on that. So that really kind of sets what we're developing and at what stage we're going to be at during the year. For the stuff that we're working on with our gallery, then it's a little more fluid.
Okay.
Right.
But we're always like buying weird things to try out and trying new techniques that may not go anywhere.
In terms of the, so that schedule, I'd never considered that in relation to product design, industrial design. Is that?
It's a pretty lax schedule compared to like fashion.
Yeah, but the model is similar, I guess. Yeah. Whether you show products, you show new things,
right?
In the hopes that someone buys them for the next season or run or whatever.
Yeah, but it's more. It ships. It would ship like maybe like 6 weeks after.
Oh, okay.
After the you go to market, right?
Got
so basically, because I think for developing product, it's so like. For us to make one thing with our factory, like a prototype, it's about the same cost as it is to make like 100 units.
Hmm. You know? Right.
So we're just going to pull the trigger and buy that 100 units.
And then hope it sells.
Yeah.
Did you, when you first started, what did you say, like 7 years ago?
Yeah. Eight, no, yeah.
Were you already in tune with the whole process of any of this stuff?
All. We kind of just had to figure all that out. We had no idea.
There wasn't a process. I mean, years ago, there was, of the independent designers that were doing this like thing, it was like...
Oh, even this whole world is pretty new.
It's all new, yeah.
Yeah.
No one did it.
Why? How did this come about? Like, why is this available now?
We don't really know, but some of that, like, so when we started, like, Fort Standard,
right.
Beck Britain also started the same year. You know,
it was the recession, so like we were trying to get jobs somewhere, and everyone was like, you know.
But also, there was nobody else with the independent studio, so like, there was like Lindsay Ottoman and there was David Weeks, and you know, making lighting, and they were the only two lighting designers in New York, right? And it's like, how many? You know what I mean? Like, there was nowhere. Who do you work for?
Mm.
And we were like, pretty young. We're like, well, if that doesn't work out, who cares?
Yes. Yeah.
We just do something.
I mean, the first thing we ever did together was these coasters, which were resin and fabric and a whole bunch of other crazy shit.
So are those the ones that kind of look like a weird cross section of a like a turducken sort of?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And we took that to the trade show, and it was a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, this is like a commercial trade show, right? We didn't understand how the separation of like, you know, what you show at a commercial trade show versus like these like more art objecty.
I mean. Okay. The market also wasn't. I mean, maybe conceivably we could sell something like that now, but like not, certainly not then. It was just like people were just, I don't know. It was so weird.
Like, what was that coaster sitting next to? What, like up against? What were people showing in a trade show like that?
It was sort of an interesting, like, realization that Chen had, which was, the person next to us had like, gummy bears that were cast in resin.
Yeah, and so they were also. Like all,
why?
Like I walked through the trade show and I was like, I see pillows with dogs on them. I see somebody took a bunch of old flip flops and made them into an elephant. I was like, oh, people like things that look like this.
I mean that, and also like at 7 years ago, the trade show, the Javits Center had there was zero people that had plants in there. It was just this like area devoid of life. And, it's sort of changed since then, but it just was this like idea that, like, if you just have something looking a little bit more friendly than the person next to you, I mean, the gummy bear is being more friendly than our piece.
Yeah,
it was just like.
Well, I mean, it's like we realized like at a trade show, you have literally 1 second for somebody to understand what they're looking at. Like nobody's trying to. If somebody's asking, "What am I looking at?" You're already screwed.
Yeah,
already screwed, right? So our solution the next season is we took just fruits and we cut them in half,
right.
And we made a silicone mold, and then we cast it in cement.
Right. And those did well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I
mean, really well. And I mean, none of that shit would fly today, but it
you works. Don't still sell those?
No. Huh. I mean, now it's at the point where, like, it really surprised me. It took, like, 6 years for somebody to start knocking them off, and you know, now you have them in Urban Outfitters. Yeah. But it's
really, how's that feel?
I mean, we're done with the idea. It's almost like I was like, oh, we're free from.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I mean, we were also trying to get them made elsewhere for years. We were making everyone ourselves, and I mean, I'm looking at the Urban Outfitters version. And I'm like, I see your production problems. Right. I know how to solve them, but yeah. I'm not gonna.
Yeah, yeah, but they were actually quite hard to like have them made in China. We were like, we were sampling over and over again, and we were like, oh, maybe there is something to, like, I don't know, whatever it is that we're doing is very specific in a way that we didn't understand. Huh. You know, so like somehow the colors were just like drab looking, or like, you know, the casting quality was not that great. But basically, you know, with that, that was like our first, like, kind of more of a consumer product, normal consumer product, you know? And that was also the reason we were like going down market was like, at the time, there was nobody like selling like really, really expensive design, right? So, like, Moss had closed. I had worked at Moss.
That's right. I forgot about Moss.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, Future Perfect still hadn't figured that out like completely yet, and it was like, you know, there was just like, also that, like, we were doing like really wacky kind of resiny wild color things, and I also think like people just weren't like in ready to receive that yet, you know. So like we're like, all right, that's why we started getting into this, like, selling like manufactured products to stores, was like we need to like at least fund making this weird stuff. Like, if we can continue to make it doesn't have to sell, but like, you know, we will wait until that catches up, you know. So when we were,
it is also great having like small objects to sell, in the sense that you don't have to. Your big commissions aren't make or break. Like, you're not just dependent on like whether or not this one thing sells.
There's
just
some stability that I guess allows you
to pay for the next couple months.
Yeah. Yeah, it is like a more like a real business, right? You like predict. It's like, okay, so you know you can predict your cash flow. It's like, okay, we're gonna get paid like in October, right? And like, you know, the holiday. Money,
blah. I mean, I will say, like, full credit to you guys. Even your, like, the stock Chen and Kai stuff is still really, in my mind, like, still very unique. Like, there's only stock in my mind because you see it a lot now.
Right.
Like, you've seen it in a lot of different stores. You know that, you know, those long casting bowls and, like, those, like, the fruit bowls, actually, I thought I saw for a while, but it was maybe once.
Yeah.
Like, things where I'm like, oh, there's definitely more Chen and Kai stuff here, there's Chen and Kai stuff here. And so they become stock in terms of they're prevalent.
Right.
But they still look... And this is what I think is so fascinating, is they still look relatively wild and very much you guys and very unique, and they don't look like they were made to sell, if that makes any sense. They don't look like they were made to...
Yeah, and that's like part of the problem is that like when we're like, oh, we're going to make something super commercial, it's still just like way too weird, you know? It's like it's still like two steps too weird,
But I think
just,
that's...
Yeah, it's we just can't help it.
But what's rad is, like, you know, like the premise for this radio show is basically for anybody that wants to do their own thing, here's a bunch of people that are doing their own thing. And especially when, and for the most part, everybody on the show is doing their own thing in a particular way. I mean, not in a similar, I mean, like in a weird way of some sort. And so it's, I think it's rad for someone to see guys like you who, even if you're trying to be commercial, let's say in that way, but you're still super weird about it, that you can actually stay weird and actually do fine or do well. And that's actually really nice to know that it's not like Chen and Guy has like which would actually be kind of amazing, like a Marriott line of like mugs,
but I'd do that.
That would actually be sweet, but you know what I mean, like it's not like you're like, oh, that's where they make their money, clearly. That's where their art is applied, clearly.
I mean, I don't know that we've taken business classes, and we've like,
oh, you have
later in in this whole process, and they're like, make a business plan, and we still
does that help? Do they help?
Real business plan.
I mean, it definitely like we're working on it more, like it actively, and it's like easier once you have the language. That's the problem, right? It's like all these things that they teach you in business classes are kind of intuitive things that you know, but like you just don't have the language to think about it in those terms. And it's just important to like give that vocabulary into your head to like to think about things more.
The business class helped in a lot of ways, but the actual like the business plan. I mean, the whole plan is like going into this. There's no. I feel like we made the objects first, and then made there's no job title for what we're doing right now. So just it's kind of like whatever. This is like what we're doing, and we've somehow made a way that make it work more or less for this amount of time.
Had you guys before the coaster? That was your first project you did together.
Yeah.
Had you guys worked together at a different place together? How did you guys meet?
We went to Pratt together.
Okay.
And I very distinctly, Kai has a very distinct look, you know. So like I remember, I was also like a year behind, and I was taking history and industrial design. And Kai and our friend Annie were sitting in the front of the class, and I was sitting in the back, and I was already scared because like it was all upperclassmen, and Annie, who Kai was sitting next to, it can be a little scary, and so I was like, oh, he must be even scary because he doesn't even talk at all.
But I don't know. It's like the. Like you graduate from Pratt and you're like, what the hell do I do? At the time, it was easy enough to just, you know, live in Brooklyn and not have to do much, which was nice. We both had studios and pretty nearby each other in Greenpoint, which was a great luxury. And
My studio was tiny, so you know, I had like very rudimentary tools. Anything I needed to do anything bigger, I'd go over to Kai's studio.
I mean, you had studios individually before you joined forces.
Yeah,
okay. We did. I was trying to run a CNC router business, which was just a terrible idea. It was just massive, massive flop.
Did you, after graduating, or even like at Pratt, did you know individually that you guys wanted to start something on your own, let alone become a partnership?
No. Not at all.
No, I mean, I didn't, you know, so right out of Pratt, the first job I got in the summer was, shout out to Evan Eisman, who was a fantastic sandblaster. And, like, I really learned how to, like, look at things in a very precise way from him. But, like, he does finishing, like, high-end sandblasting finishing. But he, at the time, he was just also starting his business, and he was making Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards.
Okay.
So my first job was, like, sanding those, like, orange blimps.
Even that, to, like you said, it's like to picture that it's meticulously handmade.
Yeah.
You don't even think about it. It's amazing.
Well, it's incredible. Like, it's an orange plastic orange blimp with a kaleidoscope that is handmade from, like, there's a... acrylic ball, acrylic tube, like the mirror that's the triangle on the side, he hand cut those. You know, it's like all these objects you see around, they're all incredibly handmade.
Like so much care going to these things.
He was also super stoked that year.
Yeah. No, this was a couple years later. But he was really stoked when Baja Men won, or Who'd Let the Dogs Out, best song, because there's 30 members of Baja Men. So he had to like basically doubled his order.
He's like, I've made it. Just vote for the big bands. Yeah.
But after that, I went on to work for Moss, which,
okay,
for people who don't know, it closed, I think, in 2012. Opened in 1994, and it's like the reason there are European design stores in Soho. When they opened at the time, it was still galleries in Soho, and you know, it's like where you would have gone to buy Alessi or you know Fitsu, you know anything, where you couldn't buy these European design goods in America.
What'd you do at Moss?
I did like the displays and stuff. So and I mean, talk about meticulous. So basically, part of my job was every morning, there were three cleaning women that would go through, and they had basically like been cleaning the store every day for 10 years. They're really good about putting everything back exactly where everything was, but my job was to like go back through the store after them and just micro adjust each
like the little 8-inch chair.
Exactly. Huh.
They would also paint the store once a week.
Yeah.
Which, what?
Yeah, like, every Friday.
That's incredible.
In the morning, I would
touch
up. I
don't think there's a museum anywhere that paints once a week.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. If you ever have looked at the walls, it's like, you know, so textured and bubbly. Yeah.
So this was, just for timeline's sake, graduated, and then you guys worked, how many years did you work before you started Chenikai?
Like 3 years.
Three and a half. Something
like, and you started it 2011.
Yeah.
Like basically following the recession. But
yeah. But like also for me, working at Moss was like what like allowed me to think about, because like Moss carried, you know, these like kind of artisanally produced design objects.
Right.
Right. I was like, oh, you know, we can kind of make stuff like this, you know, why not?
Does that mean you graduated into the recession?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Graduated 06.
Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, you're 06, yeah. 07, yeah.
But you were working during or through or just trying to like we're fucked in that 08-09 period?
Yeah, before but starting? I mean, also it's like, I mean, luckily I had gotten a job before the recession, but like we also didn't have like a point of reference, right? So I feel like people, like I saw people who are maybe like 10 years, 15 years older than this, deal with it mentally in a really bad way because they didn't understand what was happening. Whereas, like for us, we were like
I actually had money to like buy beer, and I was like,
and you're like, cool, yeah.
It's like,
what else do I need?
Yeah. Oh, we also had myopenbar.com when we graduated.
Oh yeah,
like, I was trying to show one of our like interns was like, oh, why aren't you guys just drinking for free off of this? And I like looked at, I was like, oh, I guess that guy must have been orange because that website does not exist.
He forgot how to figure out how to like monetize that thing. Well, because I feel like actually a bunch of people we've talked to, the recession was even subconsciously a really good moment to start thinking about what they wanted to do. Because it was that thing. It's like, as long as I have enough money for beer, there's really nothing to lose
because
I don't have any money anyway.
Yeah.
And so might as well try something.
Right.
And, you know, it works for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So it was, I always thought it was really funny that like, with, I think, especially the generation that we're in, like you said, that mentality at that point, most people were just kind of concerned with their own self.
Right.
Most people didn't have families yet.
Right.
I mean, in our age bracket anyway, at that point. And like how weirdly important I think that recession was for a lot of people starting stuff that otherwise would have seemed really risky.
Right.
Just because it was equally as risky, but there was nothing left to risk. So you're like, fuck it, let's just try it.
Totally.
And we had no idea.
So. Yeah, and you had no idea. Where are you guys from originally?
I'm from Midtown.
Oh, okay. Where in Midtown?
57th. I grew up in Carnegie Hall.
Oh, 57th shit.
Street, 7th Avenue.
Is your family still there?
They moved a couple blocks away, but basically.
Okay. Have you lived anywhere else besides New York?
Not really. I mean, I lived in Texas for half a year, but that's about it.
You did?
In fifth grade.
Oh.
I went to boarding school.
Okay.
I guess it's living somewhere else.
And you?
I was born in Shanghai in 85. So in China, there's like different types of residencies where like if you don't have like I was physically born in Shanghai, but my parents were, after going to college, were sent to live in Anhui province, which is like really, you know, rural, poor province. And even though I was physically born in Shanghai, like they try to anchor baby me for the city. My papers still say, like on my passport says I'm like born in Anhui, which would have meant I would have had like very few opportunities.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, like if you have not city residency, then you can't receive city services. So you can never like really live in the city. That's why there's a migrant worker system in China, right? Like people go work in these
to get that
cities,
kind of citizenship.
Right? Well, no, they get money. And they go home, and they do that migration.
But I think you can never, you can never buy into that citizenship.
Yeah, your children could never go to
no matter
school.
What. That's crazy.
Or you know, you can't receive like medical services. I think like stuff like that. Like you're basically locked out, so that it prevents like rural migration to the urban centers. I think. So basically, after I was born, my dad's like, "We're getting out of here," you know. So. He, in 91, we moved to Laramie, Wyoming, where he went to grad school. And then when our visa was up, we moved to Toronto.
Okay.
And we lived there from, like, when I was, like, 10 to 16. And then we moved here right in January of, like, 2011. So, and we were, like, super lucky because, actually, George Bush had just come in office.
2001.
2001.
One, sorry.
Yeah. So, like, George Bush had just come into office, and he went to reform the INS, and he sped up processing for, like, green cards. And so I got my green card.
I did not know that.
2 years after getting here, which allowed me to go to school with scholarship, with like grant money, basically, you know, like Pell grant money. And stuff. Otherwise, I would have to go to school as an international student. So it was like this weird, like very lucky Goldilocks moment to move to the U.S.
So like, this is probably a little too pigeonholing, but you obviously have a Kai, you obviously have a foundation in New York, and sort of like born and bred in New York, and then Chen, you sort of like circuitously ended up in New York. Because I'm always curious, like with people's environment that they grew up in, whether it changes a lot or whether it's actually fairly consistent. Is there something that, was there something that prompted you guys later in life to be like, oh, we can actually do something on our own, or we should do something on our own? Like, because I always think like it must be in a place like New York that there's obviously people doing amazing things all the time, but that may not be the case depending on where, how you grow up.
I mean, I sort of always joke that my mom is Chen. I mean, both Chen's parents and my grandparents both came from Shanghai. They're both they're all scientists. They all came into the sort of area of New York and then had a slightly more artistic child. I don't know how that happens, but I mean, my parents are both. They have their own business, and I don't know that it was a huge leap for me to decide to go and do something else.
So it was like fairly normal to see someone you knew run a business, so like your parents, I guess.
Yeah.
Did they run the same business? Were they business partners?
Yeah.
Okay. What did they do?
They're architects.
Oh, cool. Funny. Are they still practicing?
There.
Yeah. In the city.
In the city.
Amazing. Do you like their work?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like maybe I'm the harshest critic. but
I mean, it's a big sign if you can survive being business partners and
I don't know life how that, partners. I don't know how that happens. I mean, it's a little hard if I had to like live with Chen, that would be
horrible. I know. I don't think I would have anything to talk about with that. You know, like I'm always like we have friends who are life and business partners, and I'm like, What do you guys talk about?
It's not like we don't talk at work, but like at this point we are like old married couple. We talk about specific things and then like go and do our own stuff.
But it's nice to at least have that
8 to 12 hours
apart to kind of like
definitely.
Yeah.
Think of other things to bring back to the conversation the next day.
Yeah.
When you guys started, were you already doing artistic things before? You said you went to Pratt, right?
Yeah, we both went to Pratt.
Before Pratt?
We both studied industrial design.
At Pratt?
Yeah.
Had you been in art before Pratt?
I mean, to this extent that anyone is, like, all children are in art, but no, not really.
Hmm. Yeah, no, my parents, I grew up, like, around, like, basically everybody, all my parents' friends were, like, chemists. So, like, I mean, also, like, I was, like, basically, like, the least, like, obedient, like, I was not getting good grades and, like, did not play piano.
Did you have siblings?
Well, no, just one, because I'm, like, the first part of the one-child policy in China, so, like, I think they went into 81, started 81, I was born in 85. So, like, I have really close with all my cousins because none of us have any siblings. I have, like, two cousins who are, like, we're basically all born within the same year, so we're really, really close. But it is weird. Like they, this. Actually, like reading Eddie Huang's book was like really like
really?
I was like, yeah, that was like I wasn't like trying to be bad or anything, but I was just like kind of mischievous and like did not want to do what I was told, ever. Yeah. So, I mean, it was like. Sorry, what was the question?
I don't know. No, keep going. I have no idea what the question was, actually.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's back to kind of what you were saying about, like, having an example, like, who running your own business. My parents were all, all worked for, like, corporations. But, like, I think, like, the ballsiness of, like, being able to immigrate somewhere... Yeah. It's like your threshold for risk is pretty high to begin with.
What's funny is I don't remember what the question was, but I was formulating a question as you were talking, and ballsy was in my mind as soon as you said it. But it's because like part of it, I mean, a big part of that is that I don't actually know if it's that true anymore, but certainly growing up, like, ballsy Asians, there just weren't that many of, like, yeah. loud Asians.
Yeah, yeah.
As soon as you said Eddie, I was like, I love loud Asians.
Yeah.
Because there's, like, three of them, well, like, in popular culture. You know, but, there's not that many.
But culturally, like, you, if you grow up under, like, an authoritarian government, you were, like, told, you know, it's like, the story I was always told is, like, my grandfather, when he was, like, 18, was looking into a pond with his friend, and he said to his friend, look at those fish, they look so free. And his friend reported him to the Communist Party and say that he was speaking in metaphors.
Wow.
About his own state. And he's, wow. he's 18. He's just not, like, complicated yeah. enough to, like, think of like that.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, that was always, like, you know, the, in the family, it was like, don't.
Right.
You don't, you want to just keep quiet.
Right, right, right.
You know.
But it's true. I think it's totally a cultural thing. Yeah. And, like, the same thing, my parents came here for college, and just even thinking that at that time, moving to Wisconsin, not knowing each other, but they met in Wisconsin, a level of ballsiness. A lot of the guests, like we talked to Angela, who was ex-Mission Chinese, Dima Yuga,
yeah.
and the whole theme of, like, fearlessness was part of it the whole time. And I was curious, like, where that, because you always have that one trouble, like, problem Asian kid
yeah.
who's, like, funny and wild and probably is, like, hard to control yeah. in a really good yeah. way. And you hope that turns into something productive.
Yeah.
But it's still, I feel like, rare where you get Asians, Asian Americans, certainly in, like, popular culture, to, like, actually be loud and obnoxious and speak their mind and do do work that is wild or weird or very loud in itself, even if they're not physically loud.
Right.
And I'm always like, as soon as I meet people like that, I immediately want to, like, throw a spotlight on them or hug them a lot or something, because I feel like it's very rare you meet people like that.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know where I was going with that, but. Thank you guys for being loud, I guess, is sort of the point. But, and always curious if there was a model of someone like that growing up, whether your parents or someone else you saw or someone on TV.
You know, for me, I don't know. Like, I feel like in this, I got into a slew of confrontations on the street in the last year. And thinking about it, I was like, why am I like taking it to 11, yeah. you know? And I think part of it also has to do maybe with, like, growing up, always, like, watching the way my dad interacted in public mm. was very, like, I was like, why didn't you, mm. you know what I mean? It's like...
Was he fairly reticent to stuff?
Yeah, yeah. You know, he was very, like, I knew, like, my, like, we both have the same personality. We're both, like, you know, there's, like, two Rams, like, you know, just when we go at it, it's, like, mm. you know, immediately to 11, but, like...
Have you seen him and his dad fight?
I have, but it's hard to imagine that, but I've heard stories.
But, like, you know, when you see him interacting with white people, and it's like, why are you, you know, why don't you speak up for yourself, mm. you know? And, like, I think that might have a little bit to do with, like, why I'm so aggressive when I'm, like, when I have, like, these minor things happen in the street. And I'm mm. like, you shouldn't have, like, you know, just tone it down, don't engage, you know what I mean? Like...
I was trying to think, like, I've rarely ever seen my dad get into confrontation.
Yeah.
But my mom, she's not confrontational, but she's very much like, you can't fuck with her, sort of like.
Yeah.
Like, she'll just sort of soak it in and then, like, hit you with something and walk away.
Yeah.
But neither of them are really, like, aggressive, get in your face, but she's so much more of, like, a wall.
Yeah.
And I, thinking back now, I think that was a huge part of also, like, how I respond to conflict.
Yeah.
Is wait, you kind of wait until there's, like, an opportunity, then you. Like punch, like, you know.
Yeah, 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 totally.
Then you attack, but.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Also, I feel like when you're a partnership, like, I feel like, you know, Kai is not very aggressive, and so, like, it almost, like, when you're, like, have, like, a, when you're with somebody, it, like, amplifies yeah. your.
I guess you want to, like, fulfill, like, the other half of
you've got yeah. that role to play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like you fall into, like, these archetypes, right? It's like good cop, bad cop, kind of.
So do you end up playing those roles professionally, like, with the studio?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, Shane was missing a tooth for a while. That really, really helped part of that role.
Yeah. Yeah, I was, I mean.
Why didn't you just go with that look?
It was missing a tooth for 2 years, but what if you leave it out for too long, all your teeth start moving.
Oh, which shit.
Was like, I was so scared.
Yeah, yeah.
I was getting, like, these crazy gap teeth.
It works for Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
He's got, like, a weird, like, crooked thing in the front. Yeah. I forgot if I asked, but you had never been like, all right, when I grow up, I'm going to run my own thing? Or you, that was in your mind?
No, never. Never thought about it that way. Like, right. It just, like, we just happens.
But I mean, it did happen. Like, I don't, we didn't intend to do this. Like, and it does, you know, our business name is just our names because we didn't decide to create a company ever. Mm-hmm. It was just a progression of
you two working
stuff.
Together.
Yeah.
When you made that coaster, how did you decide that that was what was the first thing you were going to make?
Oh, we just had stuff lying around. We had the spandex that we were making these vases with. This is actually this vase that I was making before we started together. And this is funny, actually, with our studio name. Like, when we first started working, we were like, okay, well, you'll have your practice, I'll have my practice, and we'll just have some stuff together that, you know. And the reason we actually decided to start a company, quote unquote, was because it was too complicated to explain that to people. So it was like everything just goes into one name. It's all us, you know. Huh. So even though there's like a couple of things that like came before, we're just like, nope, this is all us together. And so I was making these vases with the spandex netting that I was spraying foam into. And then a friend of ours gave us, like, he was, like, finishing architecture school. And he's like, I bought all this resin I don't need, like, here. You know, so we were like, what do we use this resin for? Mm-hmm. And so we just started dipping things into it and, like,
hardening. We were actually trying to make bracelets that you could then slice at a store. So you could get different sections of a bracelet.
Okay. So like a tube that you sliced kind of thing?
Yeah, and we were wrapping them around beer cans, out of like Tallboy beer cans.
Yeah, so basically a beer can is a rigid form that you can mold things on, right? But then once you crack the beer and pour it out, it's a ribbon thin
right.
Thing that could just pop
it's about, right. It's about hand size.
Yeah. So our inspiration was like the deli counter. We were just like getting a sandwich one day. I was like, wouldn't it be cool to be able to like buy durable goods this way, or like just cut me this much, you know? And like,
did that project ever happen?
We came around to it again a couple of years later, and we sort of got a semi-functional thing. You didn't cut it down at the store, but it was
It was just too much like a finishing work. But actually, the majority of it works in the finishing,
like after you cut it.
Yeah, I think with everything, it's like, oh, it's so simple.
Yeah,
and then it's like to get the finish, like a nice.
That last like 5%.
Yeah, that last 5% takes.
We soak it with like 3 layers of marine grade epoxy. Like we sand it, we polish it, we have like a big buffet. It's just
well, I mean, the thing about like design, being like a designer, is like your objects are expected to perform.
Mm.
You know, like people want it to be indestructible, right? And it's like, you know, you need to like make them really work. Mm-hmm. So like getting the finish right, like a good durable finish, it's like almost all the work. Mm-hmm. I think
what that coaster, we keep talking about the coaster, besides deciding to make it, how did you decide to then take it to that trade show? Or why did you decide to take the trade
we
show?
We had our friend Kyle, who was the same year as Kyle Mead. He had this thing called American Design Club, which now is still,
oh yeah,
it still operates, but now it's more like a repping model,
right?
And like before
they do like awards and stuff, right?
Yeah, something I think like so. But like before, it was basically just like we none of us have money. Like a trade show booth at Javits is $5,000, so let's all pool our money together and get one booth.
It was more of a legitimate club.
Okay,
yeah.
So that was like it was like an ADC booth.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
And so Kyle would be like, hey, you guys want to do... And I was like, I think the first time we did it, it was like $300. I was like, why not?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Who cares?
I think we made $0.
Yeah.
We made negative dollar.
It was more like it's more like paying tuition to like stand at a trade show where like, and nobody wants to talk to you because your thing is too weird. And then just like stand there and be like, what, like, you know, it's like, what's wrong with our product? And you have 3 days where you just like stand there and think about what's wrong with this product.
Javits Center is amazing for just depression and
brutal emotions.
Yeah. But I really think a lot of design comes from like standing in a trade show where nobody wants
and
to
just
talk
be
to
like,
you.
This sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. But like also standing there and be like, look at all these people here. If I'm not smart enough to figure out a way, they flew here to spend money.
To buy an elephant sandal.
Right. But like if I'm not smart enough to figure out a way to get them to give me some money, I must be really stupid.
Yeah, need to find a different profession.
Yeah. So like, let's figure this. Like, I feel like every time there's like some problem where like, or like some mental block that we can't, like for the longest time, we didn't make anything in brass because we're like, everybody does brass. I don't want to like our product to look like other people's things. And, but then we're like, you know, people just want to buy things that are brass. And we're like, if I can't overcome the fact that, like, if I can't think of something interesting to me to make in brass,
right,
then I should quit. Right. You know what I mean? Like, this is not a big deal. Like, just get over that mental block and do it, you know?
It's also like, it's like, because I have the same thing. It's like, oh, everybody's doing that. Yeah. I shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, well, that's actually half the reason everybody's doing it. Because actually, there's something good in it.
Yeah.
And it's a dumb reason not to do something just because other people are doing it, because you hope that you do something different or better or
right,
more unique to yourself in some way. And yeah. If you can't, then you're right. It's like, yeah. Don't bother.
Yeah.
So where did your first dollar come from as China guy? Like, when was the first time you sold something?
I mean, we were, as a product, I mean, I was, I mean, there,
or as a service,
well,
I don't.
So the thing is, it was really, when we started, Moss was still open. So we had products in Moss. We knew Dave from the Future Perfect from forever. So we had stuff at the Future Perfect. Brent Zacharias, who now produces Memorial, that terrazzo that Max Land is on.
Yeah, yeah.
He had just left Moss. We worked together. He went to Philips to open a design shop at Philips. So, and it was like just opened. So we had stuff in those three places.
Okay.
Like literally the week after we started our business, right? So it was a lot of like just luck.
We're selling stuff to them. We couldn't sell stuff to like the moms at the trade show.
Right.
Yeah.
And we were also, you know, transitioning out of this CNC business. So we had some weird CNC jobs on the side and you know, doing odd jobs for Moss and a bunch of other weird stuff to begin with.
So when you were first starting, when you say CNC, that was a business you had started?
I started it like 2 years before.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and then, so Kai had this enormous studio space with like, so like, it was like very luxurious. Like, feel like we like downsized like our tools at every time we moved. Or like,
we're getting organized. Smaller spaces and less tools every time
we moved. Yeah, because we started, Kai had the biggest CNC machine in New York. It was 17 feet long.
Just gigantic. I mean, it was.
It weighed
26,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Where was it?
It was in Greenpoint.
Okay.
Like we had like a, it was like an industrial
in a dope machinery. Space. In
Greenpoint. What was your shop calling it?
It was called Three Phase Studio.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that.
You've heard of that?
Yeah. Well, because I think at that time there weren't that many.
I mean, it was
CNC shops, and there was. I feel like there were like four.
Maybe I don't even know.
Like any kind of fabrication at that scale that wasn't. Like manufacturing scale.
Yeah.
We also were at the end of Greenpoint Avenue. We were on what's now Transmitter Park.
Uh-huh.
So when they were doing construction on Transmitter Park for like 3 years, and essentially that was just our backyard opening onto our...
Yeah, it was shop. Fenced off
that's
from
so
the
nuts.
Street.
That's
and
incredible.
And removed the fence from the... From where it blocked, like,
so you had the whole park as your.
It was
yeah,
just,
after they finished construction, they like basically were watering the grass for like 3 months. So
during the summer, it was,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
The one unfortunate thing was that for the 5 years, five or 6 years that I was there, the all the fireworks were on the
other side. Yeah.
Just those 5 years.
So you were basically, when you were starting China Guy, you were still running the CNC studio or shop.
Yeah.
And cobbling together other jobs. And you were still at Moss?
Yeah. And like basically, I stopped working at Moss like 2 months into
our
studio going.
But there would be jobs occasionally and weird stuff.
Yeah. And then I also would have like crate building jobs or whatever. You know, we slowly, like in the beginning, it was like a lot of like odd fabrication jobs.
You know? As China Guy?
Just like...
Just as you got, as people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was there a moment where, like, you're like, oh, shit, we have a business?
I think when we moved out of that space into our current space, it was also, like, the second season after we started producing, like, work that was, just, like, selling in stores. So, like, dealing with that really does make you feel more like, oh, I'm a business because I'm interfacing with Nordstrom's.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah,
you know
what
I mean?
Right.
And it's like, I have to read a 30-page routing document.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like also like figuring out what all these stupid terms mean. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's like then you really start feeling like you're kind of a business,
yeah.
You know? Whereas like, I feel like if you operate solely in like the arts, like, you can have like a semi, like, run
right
semi way of running your business, you know, in a way, because you're not dealing with a corporation on the other end.
Well, especially because, and also since you guys are both, and I think in terms of the work and even the vibe of the studio and stuff, feels like an art practice,
right?
And even how you, like, for example, when you were talking about that, even the orange blimps, all this stuff is handmade,
yeah,
whereas even me and certainly a lot of people think those kind of studios are almost mechanically run,
yeah,
hyper clean. I guess what I was going to was, are there points then, or even maybe still now, where you're funny to ask, you're pretending to be a more corporately run company than you are?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think we're pretty good at, I think we're particularly good at doing that. I mean, we spend more money on our packaging and website than I think a lot of, or is strictly necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's for a very long time, we like did not spend money on packaging, but like with.
That's not really true.
No, we really resisted.
Close to the mic.
We really resisted, actually, for a lot of products that we didn't do that much packaging for, mm-hmm. You know, and it's like now we're really like the packaging is almost like, you know, half the product, mm-hmm. basically. Yeah.
But I mean, even at that earlier stage, we were, you know, everything was in very clean boxes that were, you know, strictly wrapped with our logo, and that might seem like pretty nominal for a lot of people, but it's like it was, I think compared to our contemporaries, we always have cleaner and neater, mm-hmm. packaging than anyone else at the time. But I mean, also, there's also this idea that, I mean, this is a strict pretend thing. Sometimes there are, you know. We answer emails as.
No, it's good. I mean,
okay. So, this is a tip to anybody starting a business: make up a persona.
Seriously.
For your accounts.
This is
receivable.
This is the one. If there's any cheat
make,
code
yeah,
thing,
make
this is
up
it.
An accounts receivable person. You cannot sell to people with one hand and be like "fuck you"
yeah,
with
yeah.
the other hand.
Yeah,
you know that is the number one thing you need.
So, our fake person, basically, until we were able to bring on Bella. Was a real person, by the way. Anybody that gets an email from Bella, she's currently handing out candy to kids. Was Kelly Reynolds, because it was a combination of my two favorite surfers, Kelly Slater and Dane Reynolds. And so Juan and I, who was my business partner when we were family, would just swap who was going to answer it as Kelly.
Yeah.
And Kelly's persona was to be the hard ass,
right?
So we could still be like the good cop.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you how essential that was.
Yeah.
For that, for just the politics of it alone, like the optics of like, oh, I like Dong, but I fucking hate Kelly because all she does is ask for money.
Yeah.
And you could literally, there was moments where I'd write as Dong and just be like, you know, like Kelly's just doing her job.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I don't want to step in here.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
But that's funny because I feel like that's the most tangible, single, really doable piece of advice that every company, every person starting up should do.
Yeah. Or get like QuickBooks Online, where they have that automated email that says send reminder for the invoice, then it's just like a machine.
Yeah.
And if you set it, if you do it at the same time every like month or so, then it's just like, it just seems like it's like this.
Right. You don't stress about it. Yeah. There's no anxiety like switching brains.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to think of a way to ask for money.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like this machine is asking for money.
Right.
You know,
the other pro tip is to make friends with your photographer and to just have that relationship be really good.
Yeah.
Do you still use the same photographer for all your product shots?
Yeah. Yeah. From day one. And it's really, I mean, at now it's like kind of expected that you're going to have good, clean, white background product shots. Right. But like, I feel like not many of our contemporaries had like just crisp, good white background shots.
So if a magazine asks you like send photos, you send the ones on the clean background, and everyone else doesn't, then you're going to be published. So it's like, yeah.
Pro tip.
Yeah.
What's your photographer's name? Or do you not want to give him away?
I'm not sure if he's, because it's like more of a side gig.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah, I think we've all, like, it's funny, like, we all grow as, you know, I think you grow with your friends, and it's like you just can never actually afford your friends anymore, you know, because they're just so expensive.
It's funny because
our graphic designer is also like, I mean, way too expensive now.
Yeah.
It's like we just, we completely grew up with our friends' PlayLab.
Yeah.
And, we just really minorly, but asked them to redo the website of ours. And they did, like, great, and it was easy and stuff. And they were just in here yesterday, and we were talking, and they're kind of similar, where they're just, like, really eclectic with what they do, and they're moving more into art than necessarily graphic design stuff. And I was like, so you guys do a lot of stuff. Is there one thing you guys, or what do you not do now? What do you, like, websites? We hate doing that. And I was like, oh, shit. And like, oh, sorry. They're like, I think yours is the last one. You could have said no, like, it's fine.
It's like,
not only did we not pay you anywhere near your full rate.
But it's like, you like to do stuff with friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe there's a way to kind of round this out, because what I do really appreciate again about you guys is that it seems like, certainly through the material application stuff, you guys just do whatever you want to do. And I'm sure that's not 100% true. It never is in a business, I guess. But it feels that way, which is incredible, that everything feels like you just had an interest in that sliced rock or in that weird resin pour, and then you were able to make something out of it. Do you have like strategic plans to do things you have not done yet, or is it really organic and just it goes where it goes?
It's always organic. I mean, you know, when people are like, where do you get these ideas? It's like, we're reacting to something that we're seeing, right? It's not like, we're not pulling some idea out of our brain and making it reality. It's like, this is a real thing that we are interacting with, and it's telling
the idea is changing.
And it's telling us what it wants to be. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of design is about figuring out how to connect two things together. That's where you're problem solving. But then, like, you know, that's where I feel like our mind comes into play. But like the stone itself, it's like, it's there. And then this, you know, this piece of glass, it's already there. You know, it's like, it's just a matter of like putting them together.
Cool. Well, thanks. Happy Halloween. Wait, we didn't play any sounds.
Play some more sounds. Chainsaw.
You guys should make a channel like a soundboard.
It's like vicious laughing, blade cutting sounds.
No! 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 No!